Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. With massive number of interrogations in progress, Tajikistan have taken level of repression against dissidents to an entirely new level. Harassment of family members of the exiled opposition includes detentions, demolition of their properties, travel ban, and much, much more. The recent cases of intimidations appears to be directed at the activists of Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, the only registered Islamic political party in Central Asia before it was banned in Tajikistan in 2015. The recent joint report by Human Rights Watch and Norwegian Helsinki Committee provides details of some of the recent cases, and we are here to shed light onto some of those violations of human rights and its overall impact to the society. First, let me welcome my guests from Bishkek. I'm joined by Steve Sivertlu, the Central Asia researcher for Human Rights Watch. Mahmoudjan Faizur Rahman is joining us, who's the spokesperson of Tajikistan's banned Islamic Renaissance Party. Dr. Helene Thibault, a longtime Tajikistan researcher and associate professor of politics at the Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan, is with us. And also Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog called Kishlok OZ, is joining us from Prague. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome on board.
Thank you.
Steve, let's start with you. I read your report. Stories of intimidations of family members of exiled oppositions are horrific. Accounts of violation of basic human rights appears to be widespread. For those who haven't yet read the report, please take us through some of the recent cases.
And thank you for hosting this important topic. I think from our perspective at Human Rights Watch, what we're witnessing in Tajikistan, already in the context of a widening crackdown on freedom of expression, all forms of dissent, which has been going on now in its most intense form for the last 2 years, we're starting to see, or have seen for some time, a particularly pernicious and egregious practice of retaliating against the relatives of dissidents abroad, of really hitting people at their most vulnerable. We're talking about the most fundamental rights that people possess, the right to move freely within their country and outside of their country, are being restricted. We see the interrogation in a systematic fashion, detention and harassment of the fathers, the mothers, the brothers, the sisters, the children, of people who are simply exercising their fundamental right to speak out and criticize or praise whatever they see happening in Tajikistan. And so what we've witnessed in its most recent iteration was a response to a conference which was conducted in Dortmund, Germany recently, which was held to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the signing of the Tajik Peace Accords that ended the civil war formerly in 1997. And this conference was devoted to, ironically, discussing peace, discussing how to achieve peace and how to sustain and maintain peace, and also, of course, with a critical eye and critical view to what has been happening in the country. And ironically or bitterly, Tajik security services, in a systematic way, went throughout the country from the north to the south and detained and interrogated the family members of almost everyone present at that meeting, threatening them, publicly shaming them, organizing what are called in Russian Narodny Sudy, people's courts or public fora, where the community was called out and told to shame and berate the members of these families, supposedly for, you know, in the case of parents, for raising children that are tarnishing the reputation of the nation, specifically insulting the president. And of course, threats that were very serious were made, not just of further detention, but of harm being done to them, their families, property being confiscated. And this came on top of many events over the past year of retaliation, including most notably last September during the Warsaw Human Dimension Implementation Meeting that takes place every year, Europe's largest human rights conference, when you had members of the IRPT and the other opposition movement Group 24 come out in force to peacefully protest the human rights situation. There was also a similarly harsh backlash in Tajikistan. And so we're very, very worried by this trend, and we think that it's worth being taken up in Washington and in Brussels in a very urgent way.
Mahmoudjan, how these interrogations are conducted? I know some of your family members are among the victims. Walk us through the steps to understand the process in the case of your family.
Yeah, I am not in contact with my mother for almost 1 year. She is very afraid to contact me, but I, through my brothers, I got some information. Even they are afraid to inform me or to tell me what happens, because even my mother is afraid to contact my brothers, because they know that all of mobile phones and contacts are recorded by the authorities. So last time my brother called her and told her that how is her situation. She said she cannot bear the situation, because every time the authorities, especially security officials, come and detain her and gather the people in front of the people, denounce my activities, and she saying that she is going from one office to another office like this, and she is almost 61 years old, and she has heart problems. And one of my brother, who is minor, just in the school, he is with her, and others we are outside. And she saying that she told my brother that she is going to commit suicide or set fire on herself if authorities continue to do these actions. And she, because she is old one and she has respect in the village, and when they do this, and neighbors, friends, and they are afraid to contact her. And she saying that, okay, if Mahmoudjon will continue his activities, and the authorities also, they continue their, you know, pressures and harassments and all these things, I cannot bear all these things, so I might commit suicide or set fire on myself, because the situation is not bearable, you know.
Just a follow-up question on that, Mahmoudjon, your family is going through such a difficult time, so are you planning to continue? What's your future steps looks like?
I will continue. I will never stop or cease. We are not doing bad things. We are just saying to dictators, saying no, it is enough. Don't do this. Don't do this. Even look, we are just in Dortmund. We held the peace conference. Even they don't want to do this. So what should we do? I think we don't have options other than continue to, unless we get our freedom.
So what the victims have in common, from what you understand, Bruce, so far, I guess my question is, there must be thousands of party members in Tajikistan, the ones who have been selected. What appears to be the meeting point between the ones who are interrogated these days? I mean, why these individuals were selected among thousands of other members?
Pretty clearly, they're targeting the leadership of these groups. And it's not just the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. I mean, you know, Group 24 has also had some problems too. But the most high-profile figures, the leading members of these parties who are outside the country, those are the people they're going after. You know, the regular members of the party who, you know, aren't known for speaking publicly or making any kind of statements that would be written, audio, whatever. You know, they seem to be leaving them alone as long as they're quiet. But certainly the leadership is who they're going after in this. I think it's pretty clear.
Helene, you have been to Tajikistan recently. Were these repressions visible in the society, in public?
Yeah, I think it was visible. People are afraid to talk, not necessarily in person, but the telephone communications, people are afraid that they are monitored, even though they don't undertake any actions or anything. But just to be, as Mahmoudjon mentioned, just to be associated with someone who was a member of the party can be very problematic. So I could really feel that. And this is really a change in the last 5 or 6 years since the last time I was there. So there is really a change for the worse, I would say, in terms of how much people feel they have freedom. And I mean, this has been ongoing thing in Tajikistan, yeah, increasing authoritarianism. But as Steve mentioned, yeah, this has reached high levels in the last year, and this is very, very problematic.
Steve, to continue with you, so what's the context this repression is taking place? We know in the past, whether true or false, authorities in Tajikistan blamed the Islamic Party in being behind some of the anti-government actions, and most notable of them is, I guess, the alleged connection of the party to Nazarzoda uprising in 2015. What connection such events might have to the current crackdown against the party members?
Well, I mean, to some extent, this pattern of retaliation, which I think has, in the past year at least, really crystallized into a very specific policy, as Bruce and Helen and Mahmoud John have mentioned, that target people that are specifically participating in peaceful acts of criticism in human rights conferences or other meetings abroad. To some extent, that policy really emerged gradually in that we saw security services over the last several years and up until before the party was even banned, we saw, you know, in June, for example, 2015, several members of the leadership, but not only, were approached by security services in different cities of Tajikistan and forced to denounce the party publicly, go on camera, make videos distancing themselves from the leadership, accusing the party of crimes and publicly disavowing the party. We've seen this approach of, you know, really hitting below the belt and trying to, again, find people at their most vulnerable, put them on camera, humiliate them publicly, force them to lie to the community, put them in, you know, whatever morally vulnerable position possible to take away their credibility in the eyes of the community and shame them, play on values which are so universally important within Tajik society, and twist the persona of these individuals, drag them through the mud psychologically in addition to physically. So we've seen that targeting of individuals in the most, you know, I think, despicable way emerging as a policy and crystallizing and to some extent becoming more coordinated, more aggressive. You know, we saw in September, as I mentioned, the OSCE meeting that occurred last September, what we saw were events of mob violence. Two activists, for example, that spoke at the OSCE conference last September, one was from Khujan, Khumjon Yakubov. Another was from Kulob in the south, Shabnam Hudoydodova. Both of them had mobs visited on their family homes, and they weren't just mobs of neighbors or residents. They were mobs that included school directors, mayoralty officials, police officers, teachers. And, you know, there were public meetings that were used, public spaces, community buildings, where people were, in a very coordinated fashion, directed to shame people. And so I think there seems to be this evolution or this emergence of a real strong policy, which is obviously coordinated at the highest levels. Because with these recent events, we saw a prominent pro-government think tank spokesman go on camera on national TV and say that the IRPT and Group 24 are actually terrorist threats, there are national security threats to the nation. So that, of course, he only gets that approval from, I think, the presidential apparatus, from the office of the president. So it's all very disturbing because it appears to be escalating and getting more and more organized.
Hmm. In this point, Bruce, let's expand the thing that we were talking about just before I get into the studio about the decision by the Shanghai Cooperation Organization member countries. It appears that they are also getting in line with the position Tajik authorities are taking against this party. What does this mean?
Well, I mean, they've accepted the position that the Tajik government has already taken, which is that they're now, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as of today, considers the Islamic Renaissance Party to be a terrorist extremist group. And that means that any of its members who might have left Tajikistan but beyond the territory of other members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and I would imagine the ones that, if they had left, this includes Russia, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, for instance, that they're now subject to arrest. I mean, being on the Shanghai terrorist list is the same as being on, within the confines of the SCO, is the same as being on the Interpol list worldwide. So, you know, it's going to be tough because, you know, obviously a lot of members of the Islamic Renaissance Party can't make it all the way to Europe, but they probably could make it to Russia. You know, not the leadership, for the most part, did get all the way out the CIS space, but a lot of the other people have not gotten out of the CIS space. And now, as far as at least the governments of, as I said, Russia, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan, first and foremost, are concerned, these are criminals that are wanted by the Tajik government, and it's going to be a huge problem for those people if the Tajik government wants to expand this crackdown further down the hierarchy of the IRPT and try to get the rank and file members, not just the leadership.
Can I just jump in and say that's sure. a very important point? And I think it's, to some extent, a reaction or a counter move to Muhyiddin Kabiri, the head of the IRPT, actually being taken off the Interpol list not too long ago and receiving political asylum in Europe. And to some extent, there seems to be this chess game going on where Dushanbe is increasingly frustrated and more paranoid about what they feel is, you know, perhaps a good amount of momentum on the part of these activists to make their case and be seen really as legitimate pro-democracy peace activists in the West. And the reaction to that, I think, is to go to the SCO and say, no, these are really terrorists. You've got to help us make that case. And so we see this sort of increasingly almost desperate plea within the OSCE framework and also using the SCO to try to desperately convince the West that the IRPT and Group 24 and these other activists are actually really, really dangerous people when there's no evidence of that.
Mahmoud-chan, I don't know whether you as a party has an official statement towards the developing story that's coming out today from the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's members. As far as you heard from today's discussion, what's likely reaction from your side?
It is my personal view, because we didn't sit and didn't take till now the official statement of the party on this case. Just said we, in a previous statement, we said that when the government do this for everything to criminalize the IRPT or to recognize it as a terrorist organization, we believe that the government of Tajikistan do everything, lying and accusing the party and all these things. And we were thinking that the government is doing this, and we were in the course of these efforts of the government that doing this to be recognized as terrorist. But unfortunately, I cannot say anything officially, just it is my view, and we are going to release a statement of the officially of the party on this case.
Okay. Helene, before we get into the second part of the discussion, the last point in this is keeping the existing repression in mind against the Islamic Party or the dissidents in Tajikistan. The new pressure underway by the Shanghai Cooperation Organization members, I think the most important question is what future holds for Tajikistan's Islamic Renaissance Party going forward?
I think it's actually very difficult. Maybe Mahmoud-chan has a more optimistic view on that, but the pressure in Tajikistan, I think, is too strong so that people can actually mobilize, as Steve mentioned. Yeah, ordinary members were also pressured and publicly shamed and this and that. So within Tajikistan, it's very difficult for the party to mobilize itself. It's impossible, given that now they have been put on the list of extremist organizations. And abroad, and I think there are a large number of people who left Tajikistan and are currently abroad in Europe, in Western Europe, and these are probably the people who feel the most safe, whereas in comparison to those who are in Russia, given the SCO position on the IRPT. But people feel probably safer, protected. Yeah, they were given asylum in different European countries. But at the same time, there are reasons to believe that they also track down within Europe as well. Members, even in Europe, are not specifically safe. And I don't know how in these conditions, the party can actually survive and gather enough international support to make a case.
Thank you very much, Dr. Helene Thibault. Here, I just want to step back for a while to take a larger look at the recent developments. These intimidations are taking place in the backdrop of many other recent negative developments involving violations of human rights, press freedom. So compared to the rest of Central Asia, once it appeared that Tajikistan is relatively freer society, but how come Tajikistan got to this point? How to understand the psychology of the authorities behind what they do, and why are they doing it? Where is the country heading to, and what has to happen to divert the trajectory of these negative developments? So we will continue the conversation discussing these and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast, in the light of the latest report by Human Rights Watch and Norwegian Helsinki Committee. We are discussing recent wave of harassments of opposition activists in Tajikistan. Joining me in the discussion are, from Bishkek, Steve Severlo, the Central Asia researcher for Human Rights Watch, Mahmoud John Faizur Rahman, spokesperson of Tajikistan's banned Islamic Renaissance Party, Dr. Helene Thibault, a Tajikistan researcher and associate professor of politics at the Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Oazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This recent wave of crackdown against family members of dissidents are aside, Steve. President Rahmon also taking on very basic issues involving human rights, like expressing displeasure against Tajik women wearing hijab or young men wearing beards. Besides the recent repression against the opposition members, take us through some of the other recent trends in the society. What else has been happening?
Well, you're absolutely right that the human rights situation has deteriorated across a really wide spectrum of abuses. And, you know, if you go back to the earliest deteriorations, the first signs, I think, that Tajikistan was really going on the wrong path, and I think Helene alluded to this a little bit, was even, you know, going back to 2009, 2011, you saw the introduction of incredibly restrictive laws on religion. And as some people see the interpretation of those laws as a broadside or actually an attack or a way to get to the IRPT politically. But, you know, others had viewed that as a crackdown on religious practice in general, which I think, in a way, opened up the pathways to restrict rights in a lot of other forum. And over the past several years, we've seen the freedom of expression generally, censorship, really go completely out of hand, you know, from the blocking of Radio Free Europe and other news sites to anything critical at all, to Gmail and Google going down. We've seen NGOs, the legal profession, journalists, the religious community, and, you know, and as you mentioned also, this campaign against the wearing of beards, the wearing of the hijab. So really in the whole wide spectrum of abuses, the human rights situation has deteriorated so much that Human Rights Watch has begun speaking about this crackdown as really the worst crackdown on human rights in Tajikistan really since the Civil War. And I think that's saying a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Bruce, how Tajikistan came to this point compared to Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan? In some respect, it is still somewhat open, but with every next step, it's getting closer to those countries. What happened? How this country got to this point?
I think sometime during the last 10 years, the Tajik government finally decided that it didn't want any more competition against its possible regime. I mean, let's face it, the Tajik government is basically becoming a family business more and more every day. There was a time when before the 2010 elections, that the Islamic Renaissance Party, for instance, you know, about 2008 or something, started coming out with all these programs, all these ideas about helping people with housing and, you know, all these ideas that the Tajik government had been avoiding, really trying to touch on in their own platform. And I think that kind of spooked the Tajik government a little bit, because, you know, obviously they would prefer to have a monopoly in power. So I think what we're seeing is Rahman's gotten older, President Rahman, of course. He seems to be setting his certain family members in positions where they will just take over should he be unable to perform the duties as president, or, you know, after he's dead one day. So it's really turned into more of a dynastic form of government, with his family succeeding him after that. And the older he's gotten, the more they have clamped down on any other groups that could oppose them or any voices, alternative voices that could give some alternative ideas to the population. And of course, as Steve and Elaine and of course, Makbul John know, this is what really accelerated everything a couple of years ago. You know, the Islamic Renaissance Party had been a reliable partner in peace, although they had been constantly seeing reduced numbers of their representatives in the government. I think it was down to two guys in parliament before the 2015 election. And then all of a sudden, you know, they even lost those two seats. So they'd finally gotten them entirely out of government. And then, of course, the campaign kicked in to first, you know, annul the party and say that, you know, it was no longer functioning throughout the country and didn't have the right number of members throughout the country. And they went from that to it being an extremist group, you know, in a relatively short time, you know. And again, I link this to the aging of the Tajik president and his setting his family members up to take over once he's gone.
Helene, maybe you want to jump in here. So from your point of view, whether legitimate or illegitimate, what is that the authorities in Tajikistan, especially the president Rahmon, is concerned about?
When the civil war ended in 1997, there was a peace agreement that was implemented. But this has been implemented very slowly. And the Tajik government tried to sort of establish itself as the legitimate and the only authority in the country. But those regional commanders were put in place and with agreements made. And I think some of those agreements, and I will not go into details here because there are many regional factions playing in this playing field in Tajikistan. And I think some of those agreements broke off. And the Tajik government is concerned that they might again lose power. And this is the case in Badakhshan. This was the case in 2012, 2014. It's not clear the violence would happen there. But I think there was a sense of not a widespread instability, but some instability in some regions. And the RPT was quite popular all over the country, but especially in the northern part of the country. And I think this is a way also to sideline these kind of opposition forces, regional opposition forces. They want to sideline all opposition. So the RPT is one of the victims of this increasing authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up on that, Helene, if the sidelining the opposition is the main objective behind this recent repression, so what do you think, how far can Rahmon, President Rahmon, can go to achieve that?
Well, as it has been mentioned earlier, this has gone already quite far, and it's accelerating, it seems. And it's made very detrimental to the communities, as Steve mentioned. So local authorities and local school boards, local communities are involved in this political game. Some of them might even be willing to do so because they're convinced, but some actors are possibly forced to participate in those harassment and retaliation measures. But it's damaging to the community. So this is very problematic. It's very detrimental to the society, and combined with lack of freedom and not only political freedom, but also social freedom. Yeah, Steve mentioned a couple of laws that were implemented that are very restrictive on all levels, even for teenagers to walk on the street freely. There's a lot of social control. So it's not only about sidelining the opposition, it's about totally controlling the society. Mm-hmm. And this is also something that we see that is also increasing. So there's no political freedom, but there's also no social freedom. There's a lot of pressure on the role of men and women, increasing restrictions over how to dress and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's going very, very far. It's not only about politics, it's about the society as a whole.
I agree with that, and I just wanted to add, you know, obviously taking into account that the reasons people join extremist or terrorist groups are complicated, and there's never a direct A to B causal connection between these things. They're very complicated processes. But of course, I just would, you know, I add to some of the concerns that Aileen and Bruce mentioned, that I think, especially with the IRPT, the government is doing free advertising for extremist and terrorist groups like ISIS by basically sending the message that Islam and democracy can't coexist by banning the former Soviet Union's only legally registered, moderate, democratically oriented Islamic party. And I just think back always to the recruitment video the Amon Special Forces Commander Gulmurod Khalimov made in, I think it was February 2015 when he joined ISIS. And he cited in that video, which was obvious propaganda, and there's many reasons behind it, but he cited in his reasons for joining ISIS religious persecution, political repression, the offending of Muslim women by taking off the hijab. And of course, all of that was self-serving. But I think still, given everything that Helene was just talking about, these ripple effects throughout the society, it really is so dangerous and I think pushes people into desperate positions.
Yeah. Steve, let me press you a little bit on that. I'm in no way no way trying to defend the actions by the Tajik authorities and believe that there is nothing to be defended about. But either legitimate or illegitimate, despite criticism by the international community, President Rahman is not giving up with his crackdown against what he perceives as a threat. It seems that he won't do so until his concerns are not addressed. What role can opposition or anyone play to calm him down?
Well, I mean, I'd like to hear what everyone has to say on this. I mean, I think that obviously by cracking down on human rights and religious freedom, even from the government's perspective, they're making their own situation much worse and much less stable. So, I mean, I think people that try to rationally discuss this with the government point out that, you know, repressing human rights is one of the factors. It's not the only, but it does contribute to radicalization. From a purely pragmatic standpoint that disregards the morality of all this, they are shooting themselves in the foot and they're further destabilizing the situation. Of course, Dushanbe and Rahmon don't buy that argument. They've made that very clear. And I think, though, by sowing the seeds of discord and discontent, dividing communities, he's raising the specter of more regionalism, factionalism, of ultimate desperation that, you know, really just opens up a can of worms of bad feelings toward the government that will come back to haunt the government in the future. And so I think obviously the price has to be raised, and we can talk about that a little bit more, about what the international community should do. But I think this campaign is, to me, looking increasingly desperate. And even though the abuses are getting worse, it seems like the government is increasingly almost looking even more weak by the increasingly desperate actions they're taking.
Mm. Let's open this to other panelists. The same question, as Steve said, that, you know, the actions that Rahman is taking against his perceived enemies to address his concerns, it is counterproductive, to say the least. But he's not giving up on that. So what can be done to calm him down?
Okay, I just want to add something to what our colleagues said. I just want to say that why Tajikistan has reached in this level. I think there is another factor in this, and that is the situation in the region. What happened in Egypt, in Syria, in other Arabic countries, and Rahman thought, okay, why should I not do the same for the opposition and silence them? So, and these the situation in the region helped him or supported him to do this, to crack down the opposition. And another thing that is very important, I want to draw your attention, this is that Mr. Said Mumin Yatimov, head of the National Security Committee, I think Tajikistan has reached in this level. I think Yatimov has a great role because ideologically he is very dictatorship. He studied in Soviet Union and he has this KGB mentality, and I think his role also is a great in these violations of human rights. Mm-hmm. So the opposition is trying to prepare a list of those persons or authorities who involved in these, what we say, violations of human rights.
Okay, thank you. To my earlier questions, Helene, Bruce, briefly, please.
Sadly, I'm thinking that there's probably not a whole lot that anyone can do. The first thing I'd like to point out is that, the IRPT was, I said that they were a reliable partner. Let's run down some of the examples of how reliable. The Taliban came to were the threat in the late 1990s, and the IRPT was against the Taliban. I mean, they spoke out and said, this is not the kind of Islam that we should be practicing. It's not. Al-Qaeda showed up. They spoke out against them. You know, the Islamic State, the ISIS, they showed up. The Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan spoke out against them. I mean, they were supporting what the government wanted all the way along. They watched their power base be chipped away by various decisions, by the court decisions, kind of suspect acts that seemed to emanate from the government. They did not retaliate. They did not call for big protests, call on their supporters to cause trouble, nothing like that at all. And they were still ousted, you know. So I don't know what, for the IRPT, I don't know what more they really could have done to show that they were a reliable partner for the government. Now, as far as what the outside community can do, the sad answer to that is there's not a whole lot they can do. As long as Russia and China are willing to support the Tajik government, there's really not a whole lot of pressure that you can bring to bear on them. And we know that with the problems in Afghanistan, and the Chinese, of course, are worried about their Uyghur minority out there, that the Chinese are actually upping their cooperation with the Tajik government right now. So if the West wanted to criticize the Tajik government, say that if they weren't willing to make certain moves that they might withdraw support, I don't think it would faze the Tajik government at this point. Russia has military base there. They're not going anywhere. It's been a point of pride for Moscow, if nothing else, that they do have a military base in Central Asia. Of course, they got one in Kyrgyzstan too, but they've always had the one in Tajikistan. So there's no levers the West can use at the moment to try to prod the Tajik government into moderating its policies a little bit and being more accepting groups like the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. And that's a shame, because really, I think that was one of the things, no matter what happened in Tajikistan and no matter how bad things went or decisions that were made, I was always able to say, you know, well, they got the only legalized Islamic party in, you know, as Steve said, in CIS, let alone in Central Asia. That should have been a point of pride for them. Unfortunately, it is not. It wasn't, and it isn't anymore. It's impossible. So,
mm-hmm. Helene?
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I also, when I started researching Tajikistan, I was always amazed that this was the only country where it was a legal Islamic party. And this was a sign of, I wouldn't dare to say healthy, but a positive sign for democracy in Tajikistan. And more importantly, the RPC always claimed to be sort of a wall against extremism in Tajikistan. This was a very moderate party. They were abiding by secular rules, and their platform, political platform, was quite moderate. And as Bruce mentioned, they were not a threatening party. So this is something that the Tajik government should have, as you mentioned, yeah, be proud of. This was something particular. And now that they're gone, I'm not saying that a lot of people will go to underground organizations. I don't think that this is happening at the moment to some extremist organizations or this and that, or form underground cells. I don't think that this is happening. Hmm. But at the same time, in the long run, this can become very problematic, because Tajikistan now has no political freedom combined with very limited economic opportunities. And those two things are very problematic in the long run.
Unfortunately, we are reaching towards end of our discussion. Just the last few points. I know, Mahmoud-chan, it's a very hard question to answer when your own family members are chased by the authorities in the midst of lots of other problems, problematic news that are coming out from Tajikistan. In a situation like this, if I ask you to tell me one positive development in recent months or over the past few years in Tajikistan, what that would be?
Good thing is that in Tajikistan there is, stability. This is very important for us, and the RPT always, insist and tried hard its best to keep the stability and peace in Tajikistan, and we don't want war. And this is, the main development. And just in this case, I just want to say that Tajiks, in comparison to other countries in Central Asia, more peaceful. When Tajiks were in Afghanistan and they didn't enjoy big numbers in this extremist organization. But unfortunately, as our colleague said, the government pushing people to join this extremist organization. Just I want to say that it is stable and peace in Tajikistan. It is a good sign in Tajikistan.
Mm. Bruce, the same question to you. Other than being stable so far, what is any other positive development that you recall that happened over the past few months or years?
Oh, a good thing in the recent months. I think that the Tajik people can be proud that they have showed an amazing amount of patience and endurance with the situation. Of course, I wish them nothing but the best, because I think they really deserve it. They've put up with a lot. They've had economic problems. There's all kinds of social problems connected with that. There's certainly been some unfair decisions being made by the authorities out there. And yet, I agree with Mahmoud-chan. There is still stability in the country. I don't see any signs of any unrest or anyone who's interested in destabilization of the country.
Okay. To build on, Steve, so what has to happen that these negative developments are stopped?
Well, you know, some of the ideas have been mentioned, and I definitely share not necessarily the cynicism, but I guess the realism of the other colleagues on the podcast in terms of how difficult it is to push this situation in a good direction. But I think that, you know, number one, you have to first document the abuses. I think people have to understand that this is a crisis. This is a real emergency. I mean, we've seen assassinations in Turkey of Tajik opposition. We've seen the worst kinds of abuses that we've been discussing here. And I think the first step is that there should be a consensus and an understanding and a lot of publication, documentation, research about this crisis. I think step two is that there need to be more things like we saw in Brussels about a year ago when a resolution was passed by the European Parliament, which recognized the 100 or 150 or 200 or so individuals in prison right now as political prisoners. I think it's very important that the European Union speak out, that the State Department speak out. They designated Tajikistan as a country of particular concern for religious freedom abuses, which I think really did have an impact. I was there shortly after that decision, and we saw the State Committee on Religious Affairs taking that seriously. Mm. And I think, you know, beyond those political statements and the courage of individual diplomats that are willing to raise these cases, I think you have to follow the money. So you have the Rogun Dam that needs financing. You have an Italian firm that's involved in that, and the Italian state is going to act as the guarantor of that project. So I think, you know, Italy, along with everybody else that's involved here, has to condition the doling out of money and resources to human rights improvements. I think you got to follow the money. That's where the government really starts to perk up and listen.
Okay, last point, Helen. So what has to happen that these negative trajectory is turned to a positive direction?
Yeah, I think the same, I will go on the same line, because European countries have few interests in Tajikistan. Yeah, there isn't much interaction. We could say regular diplomatic relations, but in terms of the economy, Tajikistan is not very dependent on Europe. So it's difficult for European countries to pressure. Russia would be the country that could actually act on this, but I don't think they have an interest to do this. So I'm pessimistic in that regard that Russia can play a positive role in this. European countries might, and I think that what Steve mentioned is quite accurate. Financial incentives might be the only thing that could work out.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Helen Thibault, Associate Professor of Politics at the Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan. And big thanks for our regular panelist, Steve Severdlo, the Central Asia Researcher for Human Rights Watch, and also Mahmoudjan Faizurrahman, spokesperson of Tajikistan's banned Islamic political party, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlag Owazi, for your time in Thoughts today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks to our guests. You were fantastic.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.